to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 7 p.m. Up next, Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razwazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib. This week we'll have a conversation with Middle East historian Professor Juan Cole about the ongoing tragedy in Syria and the role of regional and international players in that conflict. We'll also have a conversation with Anita Amir Rezvani and Persis Karim, co-editors of a new anthology, Tremors, New Fiction by Iranian-American Writers. Stay with us. The country of Syria is at a historic crossroads, torn between the dangerous temptation of an Arab Spring and a forced return to hibernation under a brutal regime which has ruled the country with an iron hand for the better part of a half century. What lies ahead for the martyred population of Syria, and what torturous road will lead it there? To answer these questions, we speak with Middle Eastern historian Dr. Juan Cole, who joins us on the phone from Michigan. Juan Cole is a professor of Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and the author of Engaging the Muslim World, his latest book. Welcome to Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, Professor Cole.
Thanks so much.
Juan Cole, for the past 2 years and a half, Syria has been on a steady and horrifying path towards implosion, self-destruction, and things are not getting any better as we speak. With Hezbollah's increasing involvement, there's even a risk of the fratricidal war actually spreading beyond Syria's borders. Your take on the recent developments, do you think the rebels' chance has already passed, or is the West about to get more directly involved, in your sense?
Well, I think if we looked at the map of what the government controls in Syria for the past 2 years, up until recently, it controlled less and less each month. It was slow, it was grinding, but there was clearly a loss of governmental control and territory. In the past 6 weeks, the Syrian army and its ally from Lebanon, Hezbollah, has made a counteroffensive, and it has regained some territory. We shouldn't exaggerate how much territory it has regained. It still largely lacks control in the north of the country. It still, I think, has difficulty sending convoys north to the major city of Aleppo. I think it has to do a lot of air resupply. And I think the major implication of the recent victory of Hezbollah and Syrian forces at the small town of Qusair near the Lebanese border is that it prevented the fall of the regime. It wasn't so much a regime victory as the avoidance of a regime defeat, because Qusair and Homs are gateways for the resupply of the capital of Damascus from the sea. And Qusair continued in rebel hands, and had Homs fallen, then it would have been fairly easy to besiege Damascus.
Until a few months ago, Hezbollah's image across the Arab world was that of the last effective bastion of resistance against Israeli expansionism. Today, Hezbollah's image is badly, perhaps forever, tarnished by its wholehearted plunge into the Syrian civil war on the side of the dictator hell-bent on preventing his own people's self-determination. In your view, is this crossing of the Rubicon for Hezbollah from a symbol of pan-Arab pride to a narrowly sectarian force, is this a point of no return towards further and further fragmentation in the Near East?
Well, I don't think that it's necessarily a sign of fragmentation, but it certainly is the case that the moment of Sunni-Shiite good feeling across the sectarian divide that occurred in 2006, when so many Sunni Arabs supported Hezbollah and lionized it during its defense of southern Lebanon in the war with Israel. That has passed. Well, there have been some fairly serious developments on sort of the ideology of sectarianism. Sheikh Qaradawi, a major kind of Muslim televangelist based in Qatar with a perch on Al Jazeera, has come out strongly against Hezbollah and its leader Hassan Nasrallah, has called upon Sunni volunteers to go fight them in Syria. And just yesterday, the kind of Vatican of Sunni Islam, the major seminary Al-Azhar in Egypt, wrote a letter to Qaradawi and to the Saudi ulama, Saudi Muslim clerics, concurring in the dangers of Hezbollah and Nasrallah. So you see, you know, a movement among the major authorities of Sunni Islam against Hezbollah because of its intervention in Syria.
Since the start of the Syrian conflict, ex-colonial powers, France and Great Britain, have been agitating for arming the rebels in Syria, but they seem to be, no pun intended, a bit gun-shy. In your opinion, what motivates these two countries in this kind of rhetoric? Delusions of grandeur, nostalgia, or some sort of genuine historical and cultural interest in the region that they once carved out for themselves?
Well, yes, of course, France had Syria and Lebanon as colonial possessions in the period after World War I and until World War II. The British, of course, also had a position in Jordan, Iraq, Palestine. So in the post-World War I period, these areas, Syria and its neighbors, were playgrounds of the imperial powers of Western Europe, Britain and France. But I don't think, I have a French diplomatic friend who said these kinds of interventions are Viagra for aging empires.
That's a good line. So it's about feeling better about yourself, basically.
Yeah, it could be to some extent, but I think there are also genuine security interests in Europe with regard to Syria. The Europeans are always afraid of trouble on their doorstep and what it might mean for immigration and terrorism, you know, among the two big issues in European politics around Arabs and Muslims are those two. So if things get really, really bad in Syria, and of course they already are, you already have 2 million displaced, and you could see a wave of Syrian refugees wash up in Europe. And if this thing drags on for years and years and people turn to terrorism to fight it, they could start blowing up Syrian embassies in Europe. So, you know, it could start to have a European dimension. I think that kind of security thinking around immigration and terrorism probably drives some of the French and British interest in intervening. They'd like this thing to be over with sooner rather than later.
A little bit like their motivations for intervening in Libya as well. That makes sense, but the interesting coincidence is that of all of Europe, and certainly neither France nor UK are the largest country anymore, the largest economy in Europe, these two happen to be the ones that are the most active, and the others seem very reluctant, especially Germany.
Yes, well, you know, Germany, because of its unusual history in recent times, is very skittish about military interventions, and indeed, it's illegal in German law for it to intervene militarily abroad. Although it does have some troops in Afghanistan, they're enjoined from war fighting there, which has rather angered the other NATO powers.
But more than just for themselves, they're actually impacting all the entire continent as a drag or as an inertia on movement on the part of UK and France. So they're not just aloof, they're actually resisting this movement from other European powers to get involved in Syria.
Yes, those darn pacifist Germans.
It's interesting, the coincidence between these two being the most active. I'm sure it has historical roots as well. And speaking of those, studying the past, being always helpful to try to understand the present. In the 1980s, if I'm correct, you wrote a book called Colonialism and Revolution in the Middle East. How do you see French colonialism as partly at the basis or partly to blame for the current crisis in Syria, if you see in connection?
Well, we historians always see the present as an outcome of the past. And so that's the way we look at the world. And certainly the French mandate period in Syria was consequential, even though we're some ways past it now, in some ways for the formation of the country. The French formed the modern administration of Syria. They endowed it with a unitary state. And because it is alleged by some historians, and this could be a little controversial, but on the whole and by and large, I think it's fair to say that because the French didn't want to put a lot of resources into ruling Syria, they used divide-and-rule tactics instead. And so they carved what is now Lebanon out of Ottoman Syria and created it as a separate country, and a country full of minorities, and they assumed that the then Christian majority would support France. They had good relations with Levantine Christians. They weren't right about this, because the Christians joined in the struggle for independence as vigorously as the Muslims did 20 years later, but that was their hope in creating Lebanon. And then, again, it is alleged that when they set up military academies in Syria in the 30s to train a modern army that would be subordinate to them, the minorities, and particularly the Alawite, a rural minority, saw service in a French-formed military as a form of upward mobility, whereas the old Sunni elites in Syria, you know, wouldn't be caught dead serving in a colonial army for the French. So the rural Alawite Shiites took advantage of this opportunity and so came to have a special position in the military from that period forward, and with ups and downs. But that is to say, nowadays the officer corps in Syria is very heavily dominated by the Alawites, who are the ruling elite as well in politics. And some of that disproportionate influence of this minority appears to go back to the French mandate period.
So you say it is alleged that the French actually helped train this minority, although it would fit within the general way of doing things of colonial powers, to divide and conquer, to often favor a small minority in order to dominate the entire country. So it's not a historical fact. It's still being disputed that that's what happened in the 30s.
Well, that a lot of Alawite boys went and joined the army is not in doubt, I don't think, but how strong a line you can draw between that and their later dominance in the Ba'ath Party from 1970 forward is a matter of dispute. Some people see it, some people don't.
For the past 40 years, or almost 40 years, we've seen Syria and Lebanon's histories intricately intertwined, whether it be in Lebanon's civil war, when Mother Syria was called to the rescue, or more recently with the Lebanese establishment split into pro- and anti-Syrian factions, and now with Syria's civil war spreading over into Lebanon and vice versa. As all sorts of worst-case scenarios for the future of Syria become a possibility, are we possibly beginning to see the beginning of the end of the post-Ottoman order? These artificial borders drawn by Western colonialism and Zionism, are they starting to cave in? Is that possibly what we're seeing?
Personally, I would doubt that we're seeing a real rearrangement of territory or state. You know, for all of its evident faults, the colonial drawing of these maps has tended to stick. You know, many of the countries in Africa make no sense whatsoever.
Exactly. In Africa, they really don't make sense.
Ethnically speaking.
I mean, they make sense if you think the French and other powers actually divided tribes on purpose.
Deliberately.
Yeah, deliberately.
But nevertheless, you know, for the most part, they have survived. And sometimes, as with Nigeria, they had a civil war. But they haven't broken up, for the most part. There's been the emergence of southern Sudan. But some of the Bantustans that the South Africans tried to spin off are now being reincorporated into South Africa. And states, you know, once they're established, they're very powerful. They control education, and they can indoctrinate, as Gramsci pointed out, the new generation into a national identity. And they have the guns and the army and militaries. Turks have a saying that mountains and governments lie heavy on the earth. Mm-hmm. So it's an unusual thing to happen for these colonial boundaries to get redrawn. There's a great deal of inertia here. And there are reasons for it other than inertia. The states become markets. And once market routes and arrangements are established, they're difficult to disrupt. And the corollary of that is that, you know, an enclave state, some people have talked about the possibility of the Alawites around Latakia pulling away and making an Alawite state. That simply can't happen because they'd have nobody to trade with, and they're not large enough to be a market on their own.
And yet, in the case of Iraq, the markets seem to be perhaps pushing in the opposite direction, in the direction of the centrifuge. The Kurdish part of Iraq is getting very close to Turkey, and that's one place where people are talking about so-called post-Ottoman reconfiguration and all that. Iraq may be a worst-case scenario. It seems to really be fragmenting before our very eyes.
Well, it is in a moment where fragmentation is possible. However, I would argue that if it gets past this rough patch, if it brings the Rumaila fields fully online, as the Chinese want to do, that will create a centripetal force of great power because, you know, the real petroleum wealth in Iraq is not in Kurdistan, and the Sunni Arabs have almost nothing. But southern Iraq has got lakes of this stuff. And once it came online, if you could do 8 or 9 million barrels a day the way the Saudis do, it's going to create enormous demand for labor. And the Kurds and the Sunni Arabs are going to be pulled down to Basra. It's going to be a very multicultural place. And I don't count Iraq out yet. And it could break up, but if it survives for 10 years, begins to get its act together, the petroleum industry typically is a strongly centripetal force.
Speaking of the Ottoman Empire, again, Turkey over the past decade has made a remarkable comeback as a regional power, prompting the notion that a, quote, Turkish model might be a real inspiration for newly emerging Arab democracies in North Africa and the Middle East. Why has Erdogan been so determined in his support so far for the Syrian rebels when the majority of Turks are clearly very nervous about their country's involvement in the Syrian conflict?
Yes, well, I mean, to be fair, Erdogan became prime minister in 2003 with Ahmet Davutoğlu as his foreign minister, and the two of them tried really hard to repair Turkish relations with the Arab world. Turkey had been ruled for decades by more or less a military government, which was imbued with a very strong sense of Turkish nationalism and a kind of militant French-style secularism. And Ankara, the capital, simply did not have the time of day for the Arab world. They saw the Arabs as religious and backward or kind of nationalistic in a juvenile sort of way. And they didn't do much trade with them, and they had very bad relations with them. I mean, the relations with Syria in the 90s were almost on a war footing. And so Erdogan reached out to Bashar al-Assad and tried to repair Turkish relations with Syria. He also reached out to Lebanon and Jordan. And Turkey began planning a free trade zone between Turkey and its nearby Arab neighbors. It was doing $3 billion a year with them in trade, up from almost nothing before Erdogan came to power. And Erdogan went on vacations with Bashar, and he tried to cultivate Damascus and so forth. So there are some people who see him as an kind of Muslim ideologue who doesn't like the secular Ba'ath Party or doesn't like Shiites or something, but that simply isn't the case. He gave a really good try.
People speak of a Sunni intention on the part of Erdogan, that he's part of this hardcore Sunni anti-Shia movement.
Yeah, well, he didn't behave that way for the first 8 or 9 years that he was in power.
That's right.
And so, no, I think what happened is that when these crowds began demonstrating in Syrian cities, and remember, for the first 6 or 7 months, they were largely peaceful demonstrations. When Bashar and his brother Maher decided to draw up tanks and artillery and just heavy weaponry at these civilian peaceful crowds and to commit massacres, I mean, crimes against humanity. I think it just angered Erdogan. I think he was genuinely outraged. And I think probably in central Anatolia and the heartlands of Turkey, where you have a lot of pious Muslims, many of them going to Syria for trade, maybe had relations with the Sunni merchants in Syria. It could be that although the majority of Turks are nervous about this, there's a particular constituency of Erdogan's that are very exercised by it and want to see somebody defend the hapless crowds in these cities from al-Assad's military machine.
Some people ascribe hegemonic ambitions to Erdogan's government, that somehow their motivation might be to shape the new Syria into Turkey's image, to have a little satellite on their border. That's another Machiavellian interpretation. But what's interesting to me and puzzling a little bit, there seems to be a split between either a majority or certainly a large segment of Turkish opinion against any involvement in Syria. They're really very nervous about it, and that hasn't, so far, hasn't kept Erdogan from moving forward.
He's allowed the Qataris and private Gulf interests to smuggle some light weaponry into Syria, to Aleppo and Idlib, but there's no evidence that he's sent any weapons of his own to the Syrian rebels, and he hasn't deployed the Syrian military. He's kind of acting like a helpless giant. He's called for Bashar al-Assad to step down, but then aside from not closing the border to light weapon imports, he really hasn't done anything.
Yeah, he hasn't responded to any of the provocations or incidents that happened at his border, some Turkish civilians being killed as well. In a way, I think a lot of the Turks feel he's exposed their country to a lot of dangers coming from the south. And that hasn't seemed to really deter him from his support, because he has provided, okay, non-military, but quite strong support, it seems to me.
They've provided humanitarian aid, and they are hosting very large numbers of Syrian displaced persons around Antakya. They have camps there, and they don't interfere with the Free Syrian Army coming and going. But, you know, if you take it all together, Khalil, I don't think it amounts to very much. And I suspect one of the sources of dissatisfaction is that there's a feeling that Erdogan, by his rhetoric, has made an enemy of al-Assad, but then there hasn't been much follow-through, and what you never want to do is to punch someone like al-Assad in the nose and then not follow through.
That sounds a little bit like Obama, what Obama's been doing. That was my next question. Much of the left in this country sees the U.S. as playing the same dangerous game in Syria that's been playing since World War II. Some even suspect America of fanning the flames against Assad to try to shape a new Syria more friendly to American and Israeli interests, a suspicion reinforced by the U.S. role in leading from behind in the Libyan revolution against Gaddafi. What is America's role right now, reluctant or otherwise, in the Syrian conflict?
Well, as far as I can tell, the United States doesn't have a role. The only thing that I know of that they're doing is that they have stationed CIA field operatives
in Jordan,
and Turkey. And the ones in Turkey appear mainly to be trying to make sure that Qatar doesn't send heavy weaponry into the rebels. So they're a filtering mechanism to make sure that only light weaponry is going in. I've met with Syrian oppositionists in Istanbul twice last year. They feel like the United States is useless to them, and indeed, if anything, it's harming them. They think they need the heavy weaponry to come in. And then when Obama met with Erdogan a couple weeks ago in Washington, he appears to have upbraided Erdogan for not cutting off the Nusra Front, the guerrilla group in northern Syria that has declared itself an al-Qaeda affiliate. Obama appears to be extremely alarmed by the rise of Sunni radicalism in northern Syria. That's made him even more reluctant to intervene. And he's put pressure on Erdogan to back off. So I know that there's a narrative in the Middle East, and you can understand why it should be, that the U.S. is secretly intervening in Syria. But as far as I can tell, it's quite the opposite.
Yeah, there's the opposite narrative among Syrians themselves, that the U.S. and the West in general are only too content to let this horrible civil war go on forever and destroy an adversary of Israel's and the U.S. and the region. So there's that opposite paranoia as well, that perhaps letting Russia and Iran intervene and not intervening is actually a way to let the thing rot and self-destruct.
I think, however, there's a third possibility, which is that the United States' current elite around Obama doesn't see good options for the U.S. Obama, like Erdogan, you know, did his best to try to make up with al-Assad, and he sent Ford out as ambassador and tried to repair relations. And then once the regime turned semi-genocidal, nobody can have relations with such a regime. It's odious. And forced Obama to back off and then to call for al-Assad's resignation. But then the forces that emerged among the rebels to fight the government came to be identified with, and it's not entirely fair, of course, because there are all kinds of Syrians rebelling against Bashar, but in the Western mind, the rise of the Nusra Front and some of these other radical groups, the important role played by the Muslim Brotherhood, has raised questions as to whether that's the group of people you really would like to have in charge of Damascus. And even it appears that the Saudis have backed off from their support for the Northern Front for similar reasons. So I think it's not always clear what's going on at the time it's going on, but from all of the indications that I can gather, Obama's just decided not to get involved in this thing. And it's become somewhat like Algeria was in the 1990s, which also, you know, ground on and was horrible, and 150,000 people, we think, died.
But I'm from Algeria. They're talking about 200. Officially, it's 200,000. The only difference there was that it was much less in terms of infrastructure. I mean, we didn't see entire cities blown up. So
no.
It was that the people were getting killed, but
it was a dirty war.
It was a dirty war, yeah.
Yeah, the other thing was that it happened at a time before you had YouTube. So there were all kinds of massacres and horrible things done in the middle of the night by SWAT teams that were flown in into these villages that we've never seen.
Right.
Heard rumors of them. It's really hard to watch this thing unfold in Syria because we can see it happening.
Yeah.
And that wasn't true of Algeria. But, I mean, all that I'm saying is I think Algeria posed similar conundrums. I think nobody liked to see that kind of bloodshed. On the other hand, the Islamic Salvation Front, and especially the armed Islamic group, made themselves odious to the French and the Americans. And so, in the end, you know, the government was allowed to win.
Yeah, in Algeria, it wasn't, I mean, it's a different story. It wasn't as regional or as international. It was really much more of a true civil war. Some people saw the hand of this or that behind the government, but it was really the government against a guerrilla, a crazy...
Although, you know, there is evidence that bin Laden in Sudan sent money up to the armed Islamic group.
Yes, that's true. There was that dimension as well. It was these guys who had come back from Afghanistan and didn't have jobs and had plenty of time on their hands and plenty of experience killing people in Afghanistan.
Right.
Each and every one of the Arab dictators toppled so far, whether it be Ben Ali, Mubarak, Gaddafi, or Saleh, although it's arguable in Saleh's case what exactly happened, has until the last minute tried to argue that the historic change sweeping the Arab world was not really relevant in that particular case. And Assad is no exception to that rule. He's claiming that Syria, under his leadership and his father's leadership, has been an essential part of the resistance against Zionism and therefore should be immune to any spring breezes. Do you have a sense that Assad in the end will somehow be able to change the course of, or stop the course of history and survive this terrible tragedy?
I think that al-Assad's survival, the survival of the Ba'ath Party in the short term, is possible. You could have an Algeria scenario, which the rebellion fails. And on the other hand, I don't view the Ba'ath Party as flexible enough or smart enough to survive in the medium or long term.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it is ultimately doomed. I think the time in the Middle East of these odious one-party states is passing. But it might be able to put down this particular rebellion. It has strong backing from Russia and from Iran. And the rebels, you know, increasingly are turning in directions that are denying them support. So, I don't make predictions, but you think about what are the possible scenarios. And, you know, the two scenarios that come to mind are Algeria or Libya. And I don't think it's clear yet which one it will be.
Cole is a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and the author of Engaging the Muslim World. He spoke with Khalil Bendib. To learn more, please visit womina.org or jadmagazine.com. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. The newly published anthology, Tremors, brings together 27 Iranian-American writers from a wide range of experiences. Through their stories, the authors captured the diversity of the Iranian diaspora experiences, challenging the narrow and often simplified images we encounter in the West. I had the opportunity to speak with co-editors of Tremors, Anita Amir Rezvani and Professor Persis Karim. Anita Amir Rezvani is the author of the novels The Blood of Flowers and Equal of the Sun. Persis Karim is a poet and editor of Let Me Tell You Where I've Been, new writing by women of the Iranian diaspora, and co-editor of A World Between, poems, short stories, and essays by Iranian Americans.
Anita and I have known each other over the last 15 years, and we got to talking about how much more fiction there is available now, as opposed to even 5 or 6 years ago. And so we decided that, you know, it would be really interesting to capture this moment when fiction is sort of emerging as the really important genre for Iranian-American writers.
Anita, what was your experience like working on this anthology?
I was really happy to find what wealth of material there is out there. When Persis and I first started the project, we weren't entirely sure what we would find. We had this hunch that there was a lot of work going on somewhat under the radar, say, compared to memoir, which, of course, has become a best-selling genre for some Iranian-American writers. Novels haven't attained that status yet here, but we had a feeling they were out there. And lo and behold, as we began to do the research, we began to find that many Iranian Americans were publishing fiction, but say in small literary journals or in places that mainstream people may not have discovered. So it was a real thrill for us to be able to find this material, some of which was unfamiliar to us, both subject-wise and author-wise, and to be able to present what turned out to be a really, we think, wide collection of different voices, different views, and different stories.
So how difficult was it for you both to find these writers?
Well, remember that I've been involved with this project of collecting Iranian-American writers for now 17 years. So I know a lot of writers, and a lot of writers know me, and those writers know each other. So when we decided to do a call for submissions, both Anita and I have met a fair number of writers over the years, she in the context of doing readings and appearing at conferences, and then between us, you know, we know a lot of people in the Bay Area. So some of the people in this collection were friends and acquaintances from previous incarnations of anthologies, but a number of these we found perhaps by accident. Remember also that we're talking about a new generation of writers, many of whom have attended MFA programs in creative writing, which is a new idea that, for example, Anita got her MFA how many years ago?
Not that long ago, and locally at San Francisco State University.
But all over the country, there's been a proliferation of MFA creative writing programs. And so you're having this second generation of people who are in their 20s and 30s. entering MFA programs and largely writing about the context of their Iranian heritage in some of their work, or at least peripherally. So those people are a natural draw for us. So it wasn't hard to find them because we submitted call for submissions to creative writing programs and to people who we knew were in creative writing programs who knew others.
So the themes you explore in this volume range from exile to immigration to cultural differences, generational conflicts and gaps. What struck you the most about how these authors address these issues? For example, in the first story called Other Mothers, Other Sons by Mehdi Tavana Okasi, it's about daily struggles of a single mother who's trying to make a life for herself and her child in the U.S. She's on welfare. She waitresses in a restaurant, and at the same time, she's very proud. She doesn't accept money from people.
One important point here is there's a real sense among these authors that they are grabbing and reframing the narrative of the Iranian-American experience. So the recent history, of course, has pitted the U.S. against Iran ever since the 1979 revolution, the hostage crisis. And now, of course, what's mainly in the media is the issue of nuclear weapons in Iran. But, of course, Iranians have complicated, rich, meaningful lives, and those might be part of their mental landscape, but those are certainly not the only part of their experience. So one thing we found really interesting in the submissions we got is that a lot of people are claiming and reframing the narrative in many different ways. Mehdi's stories is one example. It's a story of a poor family, not the kind of stereotyped Hollywood rich Iranian family, but a family that's struggling to make their way in the United States.
And there is another story in the book, Persis, where the protagonist says, we are like Chinese. We do look like Mexicans because of our skin color. We resemble blacks because of certain characteristics. So it's very interesting also to see this sense of multiculturalism.
I think that to some degree what Anita says follows from what you're saying, in that I think Iranians now are beginning to see themselves more American than singularly Iranian. And therefore, they are a conglomeration of both cultures or of the cultures that surround them, so that they don't have that sort of bipolar view, you know, I'm either this or this, but much more an idea of not quite fitting in Iran and not quite fitting in America. And that probably makes them have affinities with many more communities than they previously felt they had. And I think that's a generational thing more than anything else, that we're talking about people who, they haven't been born in the United States. Most of their primary formation, educationally, politically, culturally, has really taken place in the United States. And so that idea of a kind of constant comparison, which I think you see in some of the earlier generation of writers, where everything is a comparison between Iran and the U.S., is no longer quite so sharp. And in fact, it's much more about a kind of bridging and a process of becoming that is never quite becoming. And
so can you point to some of the stories in this book that highlight the issues that you have been talking about?
There's a range here. One thing that I think is interesting, for instance, is if you look at Ari Saletz's story. Ari's story is set in Iran in, maybe the 1950s or so. But what he's really grappling with is the issue of jinn, mythological figures that are said to be created from smoke and fire and are said to inhabit bathhouses when they're empty at dawn and so forth. And he's really, through a very ordinary but loving family story, he's playing with the issue of jinn and reframing it, retelling it, telling it on his own terms and essentially updating the mythology. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one really interesting example, really one creative example of what an author's doing.
Another story that I think is kind of clever and funny and fresh is Marjan Kamali's Tehran Party from the novel Together Tea, which was just published actually in May this year. Even though it takes place in Iran, the rest of the novel also is partly in the United States. And it's this idea of how does one reconcile oneself to a culture that one doesn't really belong to fully anymore? So this is a mother and a daughter relationship, and her mother is very preoccupied with getting her daughter a suitor in order to be married, and her daughter doesn't really want to be engaged in that kind of arranged marriage situation. But it's very humorous, the kind of navigation through these cultural expectations between mother and daughter. It's no longer tragic, but it's humorous, or one can see the idea that these cultures have very many things in common, but there are some things that really an older generation of people adhere to still that is irrelevant to the younger generation.
I think it's also interesting that a number of these Iranian writers have chosen not to write about Iran at all. Mm-hmm. So we have a whole section in the book called Other Land, which consists of writing that takes place in Cambodia, that takes place amongst Native Americans in the United States. And these writers, for whatever reason, have decided that their inspiration comes from elsewhere. But what's interesting, I think, is that there is a sense of cultural hybridity there. There is a sense of what you mentioned earlier, that Iranians feel themselves to be part of an ethnic group that can relate to other ethnic groups and their struggles precisely because of the troubles that Iranians have gone through in the United States.
That's right, because they don't have that kind of exclusive notion about to be Iranian is to be either better than or a kind of nostalgic view of Iran in culture, separated and divorced from Iran. I see it among my students, for example, recognize that they have more in common, for example, with their Arab and Muslim friends than they do sometimes with their own parents because of that. And I tried to, in the story that I wrote, I tried to capture a little bit about that whole post 9/11 sensibility that I don't know if you read the story, but there's an older gentleman and part of what he's experiencing is the sudden recognition that he has more in common with the Somali men that he's being detained with in the LA County jail than he does, for example, with other Iranians back home or among Americans who might be of the same class as him. And I think that's a kind of really interesting cultural navigation that Iranians have had to perform, is to recognize that, you know, their affinities are not as solidly with Iran anymore because of what's happened, because of how hard it is for some people to go back, because of they don't like the regime, they don't like the lifestyle in Iran, and their children can't go easily back. So I think that it's a natural outcome to recognize that we're more American and we're also something different than just being American.
Another story that was very interesting for me was Erika Abrahamian's story, which revolved around this old man who leaves Iran just like a couple of weeks before the 2009 elections. What was about that story that caught your attention and you picked that for your anthology?
One thing that was important, of course, was how well written the stories were. And that one, I think, is very well written. But it's interesting you bring that up because at least three of the stories of the book reference the 2009 protests. Mm-hmm. And it's not surprising, of course, that so many writers in the United States of Iranian descent were deeply moved and influenced by that event, including the graphic novel excerpt we have by Amir Khalil,
Zahra's Paradise,
from Zahra's Paradise, which directly references that.
Yeah, and I think the idea that people got to see Iran through the events of 2009 in a fresh way that was outside the frame of this rhetorical standoff between the U.S. and Iran, but was actually bringing young people and young people's aspirations and voices and images to Americans was so powerful. I found people on the BART train. I remember a woman said to me, I got my Twitter feed on Iran and I'm following the events in Iran, and she was this middle-aged American woman, and somehow we got talking about it. And I think that because of that event, in a way, it's given some Iranian writers, I think, the idea it's more information about Iran for American audiences than perhaps was previously available. It left a stark image. And of course, the Arab Spring followed. And I think some of the same images of young Arab people rising up against their corrupt regimes has had some of the same effect, to rethink how we look at the Middle East and how we look at some of these countries which have been cemented in these sort of authoritarian and very antiquated ideas about how the Middle East functions.
Anita, what was really also interesting to me about this short story, Tremors, was the fact that this man represented a collective longing for political change in Iran or a path to democratization, because he has seen quite a bit in his long life. But his hopes seemed to be dashed one more time as he was watching on TV horrific images of Iranian protesters being beaten and killed in the streets of Tehran in 2009. What did you think about this character?
I think you're absolutely right about his longing, that it's very deep in that story. And what it makes me think of, that I think people in the U.S. often forget, is that Iranians have been struggling for democracy for at least 100 years. We can trace it back at a minimum to the 1906 Constitutional Revolution, and which had very mixed results. Of course, it got Iran a constitution. It got Iranians the right to vote for representation for the first time in thousands of years. But then that right was taken away or modified through successive shahs, through the Islamic Republic, and yet Iranians have kept fighting for it over and over and over again. So what really strikes me when I think about the last 100 years of Iranian history is how brave people are.
I think the other thing I would add to what Anita just said is also this idea of resilience, that Iran is really a place of incredible resilience, that people endure hardship, economic difficulties, and now, of course, sanctions and repressive government after repressive government, and have a certain perseverance and ability to sustain themselves despite those things. If you think about how much loss people had, both in the moments before the revolution and then immediately after, I mean, pretty much everybody has had a son or a daughter who was in jail, and everybody knows somebody who was executed. So that's an incredible moment of thinking a little bit about how Iran's history has touched people. And I know in my own family, and probably Anita's family and your family, Iranians are scattered all over the globe because of this historical event of 1979. And because of that, I think people have been forced to rethink what Iran is to them and their connection to it. But there is something that is enduring, and I think it is this idea of some kind of resilience of culture and a sense of resilience about, you know, withstanding history and still going on. And I hope, of course, that we can continue to see that even despite the condition that Iranians are living with today.
And you have divided the anthology into two segments, and that's the title of the second section, Iran, Land of Resilience. Why did you choose the title of her short story to be the title of the book?
Well, we were sort of fishing around for a title, and I too was really taken by that story. But I was also taken by the idea of literally what Tremors implies. You can think of it, you know, in terms of a human shaking hand, as in somebody who has Parkinson's. But I think of it more in terms of California and our experience of earthquakes. And tremors are the moment before and after a major happening, a major geological happening like an earthquake. And so when we said, wow, tremors, think of that, that this in a way is a representation of that kind of moment where something is shifting. And I think we, Anita and I, really agree that there's a kind of shift that's available in these stories that represents a moment where Iranian Americans are really representing themselves in a bolder and more fresh way through the act of writing fiction than I think I can say previously was available in, say, poetry and memoir. I think they're taking more risks. I think that they're not afraid to be self-critical. I think some of the stories are deeply engaged with the idea of criticizing our culture from the inside and saying, you know, our attitude towards, you know, homophobia or our attitude towards nostalgia are getting in the way of something that makes it possible for us to be fully present.
Before we end, I would like for both of you to read from Tremors. Anita, you have a short story which is excerpted from your novel, Equal of the Sun. Would you read a passage from that?
Sure. Just a bit of introduction. So I'm going to read to you from my recent novel, which is called Equal of the Sun. It's set in the 16th century in Iran around the time of Queen Elizabeth's rule in England and Philip II's rule in Spain. So it opens in the year 1576. Iranian history is so vast and complex that it really is a playground for a novelist. And I've chosen to set my novels in previous periods because I think they offer such rich history, including the history of women. There are so many stereotypes about Middle Eastern women in our current culture. And yet when you go back and look in history, you find out a lot that's really fascinating. And one of the fascinating real-life characters in Iranian history is an Iranian princess named Parikhan Khanum, who was the daughter of the second Shah of the Safavi dynasty and who had an extremely extensive involvement in the politics of the period and was a major power player at court. I bet that very few Iranians know this story, and certainly very few Americans know it. So,
well, they can read your novel as a starting point.
So I'll read to you from the first chapter. I'm in the middle here, and this is a first meeting between Pari and a man who's a eunuch who wishes to be hired by her. And she says to him, "Why do you want to serve me? I was honored with the care of your brother, Mahmud, for many years, and then I served as his mother's vizier. Now that she's no longer at court, I crave more responsibility." That wasn't the real reason, of course. Many ambitious men ascended the ranks by serving the royal women, and that was what I wanted to do. "That's good," Pari replied. "You'll have to be bold to survive in my employ." "I like a challenge," and said so. Pari arose abruptly and walked to the alcoves in her wall, pausing before a large turquoise bowl whose design showed a black peacock fanning its beautiful tail. "This is a valuable old bowl," she said. "Where do you think it's from?" "Nishapur?" "Of course," she scoffed. Sweat traveled down the back of my neck as I tried to decipher a few hints from the color, the pattern, and the brushwork. "Taimur's dynasty," I added quickly, though I could not say whose reign. Pari lifted the bowl to admire it, holding it in her hands like a newborn baby, and I admired it with her. The turquoise was so brilliant, it was as if the glaze were made of gemstones, and the peacock looked as if it might peck for grain. Suddenly, Pari opened her hands and let the bowl fall to the floor, where it shattered into a thousand pieces. A shard came to rest near my bare feet. "What do you have to say about that?" she asked, in a tone as sour as green almonds. "No doubt your courtiers would say that it was a shame for such a costly and beautiful bowl to be destroyed, but that since the act was committed by a royal person, it is a fine thing." "That's exactly what they would say," she replied, kicking one of the shards with a bored look. "I don't imagine you would believe they meant it." She looked up, interested. "Why not?" "Because it's nonsense." I waited with bated breath until Pari laughed. Then she clapped her hands to summon one of her ladies. "Bring in my bowl." The lady returned with a bowl of a similar pattern and placed it in the alcove, while a maid swept up the shattered pottery. I bent down and examined the shard near my foot. The peacock's head looked fuzzy, unlike the crisp lines on the bowl that had been brought in, and I understood that she had broken a copy. Pari was watching me closely. I smiled. "Did I surprise you?" "Yes." "You didn't show it." I took a deep breath.
Thank you, Anita. And Persis, would you read an excerpt from your own short story?
Yes, this is called Something to Pray For, and it's a story about an older Iranian gentleman who was part of the sweep of Middle Eastern immigrants after 9/11 in December 2002, when John Ashcroft called for a special registration for immigrants from certain countries. And so he voluntarily goes into the LA County offices of the INS and he's detained. And this is sort of his story of being behind bars in the U.S. for a few days and coming to grips with the criminalization of Iranians, for example. Mohsen's eyes moved across the poster as if searching for someone he knew. each image of a bearded man bled into the next, and for a second he thought he might see his son's face. His head began to perspire again when he caught a glimpse of his own reflection in the glass, reflecting the hallway's light. He was unshaven, old, and against the image of the young people he saw his face blur into theirs. "Sir, let's keep moving," the officer said when Mohsen stopped and continued to stare at the poster. Mohsen shuffled along the hallway until they reached a double glass door. The officer opened it and gestured to a chair beside a steel desk. A man looked up at him from behind the desk. "Have a seat, Mr. Amame. I'm Officer Smith, FBI. The man was well-dressed and had no badges or name tag. He wore a blue suit with a plain gray shirt and had small, framed, rectangular glasses. He had a hint of gray in his full head of brown hair. Mohsen sat down in the chair and quietly asked, "How much longer will you keep us here?" "Not too much longer, Mr. Amami. The FBI, INS, and local authorities are just trying to keep us all safe." "Sir, you know why you're here. We've had a terrible attack on our country, and we need good people like yourself to help us uncover any other threats. Can you help?" "Help? With what? I'm a good Muslim. I pray. I pay my taxes. I came to this country almost 20 years ago, and I don't see why you're holding me. I haven't been able to speak to my wife since yesterday." "Mr. Amami, as you well know, the United States was attacked. We're at war. We just want to make sure that everyone who is here is legal and that if you know anything, you'll tell us." "Tell you what, sir? Names, organizations, people you think we should keep an eye on?" Mohsen took a deep breath and swallowed. For a moment, he thought of his son again. Eskandar had written in code from prison about the ways that he'd been tortured and asked for names of people, other activists, students, the names of neighbors who demonstrated against the regime in that period just after the revolution. "I want to know what my rights are, please," Mohsen said. "I think I should have a lawyer and be allowed to speak with my family." "Mr. Amami, you're not under arrest or being charged with anything. There's no need for lawyers. We just want to know if you know anything that can be helpful. People or other Iranians who might be involved with things that we should be concerned about." In all the years that Mohsen had lived in Los Angeles, he'd never once corrected the repeated mispronunciation of his country. This time, he could not resist. "I am from Iran. We say Iranian, not Iranian. Can't you say it correctly?" "Mr. Amami, the point is, we need your cooperation. I understand your family came as refugees and that your son was involved in political activity back in your country. We know he was in prison and was charged with terrorism there." Mohsen's temples turned blood red. "Curse them. Curse that country. Curse this one. That's my son. He was murdered. He was just a kid, an idealistic kid who believed in democracy and wanted change in our country. He joined a group that believed they could make a revolution, and they did. They got rid of the Shah, but then he felt betrayed by the new regime because they'd forsaken the revolution they'd fought for. Do you know how many people like him ended up in prison? Do you know how many of them were murdered in the name of fighting for freedom? Do you know how many of those men out there sitting in that cold room had sons killed in Iran? If they weren't killed in a jail, they were killed in the war with Iraq. They were against this regime and the one before it."
Persis Karim and Anita Amir Rezvani are co-editors of the new anthology Tremors, New Fiction by Iranian-American Writers. To learn more about this week's program, visit vomina.org or jadmagazine.com. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. For this week, this has been Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. We look forward to your comments and suggestions. You may reach us by email at vomekpfa@yahoo.com or by phone at 510-848-6767, extension 632.
You can download the podcast of our program on the archives page of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa at kpfa.org. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. Join us again next week for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
Bay Area Girls Rock Camp is a nonprofit dedicated to empowering girls through music. Our summer camp is a week-long program for girls ages 8 to 18. Campers attend instrument lessons, form a band, collaboratively write an original song, participate in daily music and empowerment-related workshops, and then perform with their band at the live showcase. You are invited to the Bay Area Girls Rock Camp Summer Showcase, Saturday, June 29th at the New Parish. The New Parish is located at 579 18th Street at San Pablo in Oakland, California. Doors open at 2 p.m., shows at 3 p.m., and no one is turned away for lack of funds. Youth 18 and under are free. This is a benefit for Bay Area Girls Rock Camp, ensuring that all girls can attend our programs regardless of their family's financial situation. You rock!